Chapter 49. The shabbiness of our English capital, as compared with Paris, Bordeaux, Frankfurt, Milan, Geneva, almost any important town on the continent of Europe, I find very striking after an absence of any duration in foreign parts. London is shabby in contrast with Edinburgh, with Aberdeen, with Exeter, with Liverpool, with a bright little town like Bury St. Edmunds. London is shabby in contrast with New York, with Boston, with Philadelphia. In detail, one would say it can rarely fail to be a disappointing piece of shabbiness to a stranger from any of those places. There is nothing shabbier than Drury Lane, in Rome itself. The meanness of Regent Street, set against the great line of boulevards in Paris, is as striking as the abortive ugliness of Trafalgar Square, set against the gallant beauty of the Place de la Concorde. London is shabby by daylight, and shabbier by gaslight. No Englishman knows what gaslight is, until he sees the Rue de Rivoli, and the Palace Royal after dark. The mass of London people are shabby. The absence of distinctive dress has, no doubt, something to do with it. The porters of the Vintners' Company, the draymen, and the butchers, are about the only people who wear distinctive dresses, and even these do not wear them on holidays. We have nothing which for cheapness, cleanliness, convenience, or picturesqueness, can compare with the belted blouse. As to our women, next Easter or Whitsuntide, look at the bonnets at the British Museum or the National Gallery, and think of the pretty white French cap, the Spanish mantilla, or the Genoese mazero. Probably there are not more second-hand clothes sold in London than in Paris, and yet the mass of the London population have a second-hand look which is not to be detected on the mass of the Parisian population. I think this is mainly because a Parisian workman does not in the least trouble himself about what is worn by a Parisian idler, but dresses in the way of his own class, and for his own comfort. In London, on the contrary, the fashions descend, and you never fully know how inconvenient or ridiculous a fashion is until you see it in its last descent. It was but the other day, on the race course, that I observed four people in a barouche deriving great entertainment from the contemplation of four people on foot. The four people on foot were two young men and two young women. The four people in the barouche were two young men and two young women. The four young women were dressed in exactly the same style. The four young men were dressed in exactly the same style. Yet the two couples on wheels were as much amused by the two couples on foot as if they were quite unconscious of having themselves set those fashions, or of being at that very moment engaged in the display of them. Is it only in the matter of clothes that fashion descends here in London, and consequently in England, and thence shabbiness arises? Let us think a little, and be just. The black country round about Birmingham is a very black country, but is it quite as black as it has been lately painted? An appalling accident happened at the People's Park near Birmingham this last July, when it was crowded with people from the black country, an appalling accident consequent on a shamefully dangerous exhibition. Did the shamefully dangerous exhibition originate in the moral blackness of the black country, and in the black people's peculiar love of the excitement attendant on great personal hazard, which they looked on at, but in which they did not participate? Light is much wanted in the black country. Oh, we are all agreed on that. But we must not quite forget the crowds of gentle folks who set the shamefully dangerous fashion either. We must not quite forget the enterprising directors of an institution vaunting mighty educational pretenses, who made the low sensation as strong as they possibly could make it, by hanging the Blondin rope as high as they possibly could hang it. All this must not be eclipsed in the blackness of the black country. The reserved seats high up by the rope, the cleared space below it, so that no one should be smashed but the performer, the pretense of slipping and falling off, the baskets for the feet and the sack for the head, the photographs everywhere, and the virtuous indignation nowhere, all this must not be wholly swallowed up in the blackness of the jet-black country. Whatsoever fashion is set in England, is certain to descend. This is a text for a perpetual sermon on care in setting fashions. When you find a fashion low down, look back for the time, it will never be far off, when it was the fashion high up. This is the text for a perpetual sermon on social justice. From imitations of Ethiopian serenaders, to imitations of princes' coats and waistcoats, you will find the original model in St. James Parish. When the serenaders become tiresome, trace them beyond the Black Country. When the coats and waistcoats become insupportable, refer them to their source in the Upper Todi regions. Gentlemen's clubs were once maintained for purposes of savage party warfare. Working men's clubs of the same day assumed the same character. Gentlemen's clubs became places of quiet and offensive recreation. Working men's clubs began to follow suit. If working men have seemed rather slow to appreciate advantages of combination which have saved the pockets of gentlemen and enhanced their comforts, it is because working men could scarcely, for want of capital, originate such combinations without help, and because help has not been separable from that great impertinence, patronage. The instinctive revolt of his spirit against patronage is a quality much to be respected in the English working man. It is the base of his best qualities. Nor is it surprising that he should be unduly suspicious of patronage, and sometimes resentful of it, even where it is not, seeing what a flood of washy talk has been let loose on his devoted head, or with what complacent condescension the same devoted head has been smoothed and patted. It is a proof to me of his self-control that he never strikes out pugilistically, right and left, when addressed as one of my friends, apostrophe or my assembled friends, that he does not become inappeasable and run amok like a Malay whenever he sees a biped in broadcloth getting on a platform to talk to him, that any pretense of improving his mind does not instantly drive him out of his mind, and cause him to toss his obliging patron like a mad bull. For, how often have I heard the unfortunate working man lectured, as if he were a little charity child, humid as to his nasal development, strictly literal as to his catechism, and called by Providence to walk all his days in a station in life represented on festive occasions by a mug of warm milk and water and a bun. What popguns of jokes have these ears tingled to hear let off of them, what assonant sentiments, what impotent conclusions, what spelling book moralities, what adaptations of the orator's insufferable tediousness to the assumed level of his understanding. If his sledgehammers, his spades and pickaxes, his saws and chisels, his paint pots and brushes, his forges, furnaces, and engines, the horses that he drove at his work, and the machines that drove him at his work, were all toys in one little paper box, and he the baby who played with them, he could not have been discoursed to more impertinently and absurdly than I have heard him discoursed to times innumerable. Consequently, not being a fool or a fawner, he has come to acknowledge his patronage by virtually saying, "Let me alone. If you understand me no better than that, sir and madam, let me alone. You mean very well, I dare say, but I don't like it, and I won't come here again to have any more of it." Apostrophe, whatever is done for the comfort and advancement of the working man must be so far done by himself as that it is maintained by himself. And there must be in it no touch of condescension, no shadow of patronage. In the great working districts, this truth is studied and understood. When the American Civil War rendered it necessary, first in Glasgow, and afterwards in Manchester, that the working people should be shown how to avail themselves of the advantages derivable from system, and from the combination of numbers, in the purchase and the cooking of their food, this truth was above all things borne in mind. The quick consequence was that suspicion and reluctance were vanquished, and that the effort resulted in an astonishing and a complete success. Such thoughts passed through my mind on a July morning of this summer, as I walked towards Commercial Street, not on Commercial Street, Whitechapel. The Glasgow and Manchester system had been lately set a-going there by certain gentlemen who felt an interest in its diffusion, and I had been attracted by the following handbill printed on rose-colored paper. Self-supporting cooking depot for the working classes, Commercial Street, Whitechapel, where accommodation is provided for dining comfortably 300 persons at a time. Open from 7 a.m. till 7 p.m. Prices. All articles of the best quality. Cup of tea or coffee 1 penny, bread and butter 1 penny, bread and cheese 1 penny, slice of bread 1 half penny, or 1 penny, boiled egg 1 penny, ginger beer 1 penny, the above articles always ready. Besides the above may be had, from 12 to 3 o'clock, bowl of scotch broth 1 penny, bowl of soup 1 penny, plate of piattos 1 penny, plate of minced beef 2 pence, plate of cold beef 2 pence, plate of cold ham 2 pence, plate of plum pudding or rice 1 penny, as the economy of cooking depends greatly upon the simplicity of the arrangements with which a great number of persons can be served at one time. The upper room of this establishment will be especially set apart for a public dinner every day from 12 till 3 o'clock, consisting of the following dishes: bowl of broth or soup, plate of cold beef or ham, plate of piattos, plum pudding or rice. Fixed charge for 5d the daily papers provided. N.B. This establishment is conducted on the strictest business principles, with the full intention of making it self-supporting, so that everyone may frequent it with a feeling of perfect independence. The assistance of all frequenting the depot is confidently expected, and checking anything interfering with the comfort, quiet, and regularity of the establishment. Please do not destroy this handbill, but hand it to some other person whom it may interest. The self-supporting cooking depot, not a very good name, and one would rather give it an English one, had hired a newly built warehouse that it found to let. Therefore it was not established in premises specially designed for the purpose. But, at a small cost, they were exceedingly well adapted to the purpose. Being light, well ventilated, clean, and cheerful. They consisted of three large rooms. That on the basement story was the kitchen, that on the ground floor was the general dining room, that on the floor above was the upper room referred to in the handbill, where the public dinner at 4 pence halfpenny a head was provided every day. The cooking was done, with much economy of space and fuel, by American cooking stoves, and by young women not previously brought up as cooks. The walls and pillars of the two dining rooms were agreeably brightened with ornamental colors. The tables were capable of accommodating 6 or 8 persons each. The attendants were all young women, becomingly and neatly dressed, and dressed alike. I think the whole staff was female, with the exception of the steward or manager. My first inquiries were directed to the wages of this staff. Because, if any establishment claiming to be self-supporting live upon the spoliation of anybody or anything, or eke out a feeble existence by poor mouths and beggarly resources, as too many so-called mechanics institutions do, I make bold to express my uncommercial opinion that it has no business to live, and had better die. It was made clear to me by the account books that every person employed was properly paid. My next inquiries were directed to the quality of the provisions purchased, and to the terms on which they were bought. It was made equally clear to me that the quality was the very best, and that all bills were paid weekly. My next inquiries were directed to the balance sheet for the last 2 weeks only, the third and fourth of the establishment's career. It was made equally clear to me that after everything bought was paid for, and after each week was charged with its full share of wages, rent and taxes, depreciation of plant in use, and interest on capital at the rate of 4% per annum, the last week had yielded a profit of, in round numbers, £1.10, and the previous week a profit of £6.10. By this time I felt that I had a healthy appetite for the dinners. It had just struck 12, and a quick succession of faces had already begun to appear at a little window in the wall of the partitioned space, where I sat looking over the books. Within this little window, like a pay box at a theater, a neat and brisk young woman presided to take money and issue tickets. Everyone coming in must take a ticket. Either the fourpence halfpenny ticket for the upper room, the most popular ticket, I think, or a penny ticket for a bowl of soup, or as many penny tickets as he or she choose to buy. For 3 penny tickets one had quite a wide range of choice. A plate of cold boiled beef and potatoes, or a plate of cold ham and potatoes, or a plate of hot minced beef and potatoes, or a bowl of soup, bread, and cheese, and a plate of plum pudding. Touching what they should have, some customers on taking their seats fell into a reverie, became mildly distracted, postponed decision, and said in bewilderment, they would think of it. One old man I noticed when I sat among the tables in the lower room, who was startled by the bill of fare, and sat contemplating it, as if it were something of a ghostly nature. The decision of the boys was as rapid as their execution, and always included pudding. There were several women among the diners, and several clerks and shopmen. There were carpenters and painters from the neighboring buildings under repair, and there were nautical men, and there were, as one diner observed to me, some of most sorts. Apostrophe some were solitary, some came two together, some dined in parties of 3 or 4, or 6. The latter talked together, but assuredly no one was louder than at my club in Pall Mall. One young fellow whistled in rather a shrill manner while he waited for his dinner, but I was gratified to observe that he did so in evident defiance of my uncommercial individuality. Quite agreeing with him, on consideration, that I had no business to be there unless I dined like the rest, I went in, apostrophe as the phrase is, for 4d/2d. The room of the 4d/2d banquet had, like the lower room, a counter in it, on which were ranged a great number of cold portions ready for distribution. Behind this counter, the fragrant soup was steaming in deep cans, and the best cooked of potatoes. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.